Today is Wednesday, November 1st, 2022. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm just fine, Tom.
Great. Glad to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. In part 7, you were leading us up to a horse packing trip on the Esplanade layer of the rock units there in Western Grand Canyon on the north side of the Colorado River. This was roughly in 1967-68. Is that right?
Right.
Can you tell us about that trip?
I will. I had gotten to know a lot of the cattlemen up around White Springs and National Monument and Moccasin, Arizona, the little pioneer town that's there, and had gone into the canyon a couple times with the cattlemen as they moved their cattle and horses down Kanab Canyon for the winter. And I really just wanted to see, well, it was just a good skill to have in that country to be able to pack saddle a horse, pack a horse or mule, I know how to tie it on right, and actually go out and go for several days in pretty wild country. And the idea, it appealed to me because I had a 4x5 view camera by then, and I'm trying to think on the first time I went around there, I know I did not have the 8x10 with me, because that I didn't want to risk on a wild bucking horse in the canyon until I knew what I was doing.
Okay.
So I had that, and then prior to that, I had mentioned how John Riffey was part of this whole expedition and had showed, made the back roads, where the trails. We flew around there two or three times, that whole end of the canyon from Kanab Creek to Parashant, for instance, and looking at the trails, which were made by the cattlemen, because at this point there were still cattle actively grazed on the Esplanade most of the way around there. A couple of the permits had been forfeited when the holder had passed away as an elderly person, but they were just trails, as I mentioned, where it crossed the head of a canyon, where they actually built a little bit of trail down to the wash and up the other side, not more than 20, 30, 50 feet. But we checked those out. And then the main thing that Riffey wanted to impress on me, and I knew full well, was the water was the key.
Huh.
And there were a couple springs. There was a spring at 151 Canyon in the head of Tuckup and the head of June Canyon, and then around at Torowee. So that's not much water for I don't know how far that really is when you go in and out and in and out.
Right.
It's a lot of miles. But the key was the water pockets. And anyone who's been on the road out to Torowie Point in the, now the National Park, you drive by. Once you get up on the Esplanade and the road really gets rough, if you look either side, it's hard to miss the water pockets there. And after a rain, they fill up with water. But they can be quite large. I've seen several that were, I'd say, 30 feet across and 3 feet deep. The bottom's flat in it. And in a summer thunderstorm could fill them up easily, but nobody's out there and nobody's going to go out there in the summer. And the thunderstorms are so spotty that one water pocket could be full and all the others not full.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing is when the water pockets fill up, all the unique aquatic life appears,
right,
that you don't know is in there. And the best ones are these little kind of, they look just like horseshoe crabs with a circular round shell,
mm-hmm,
with a pointy tail coming out. And they're about the size, a little bigger than a quarter. And it's so amazing to see, you know, to be there and there's nothing but clear water, and 2 days later there are all these horseshoe crabs, brine shrimp, and they go through their whole life cycle in the next couple weeks that it takes for the water to evaporate.
Right.
And these tanks are what makes the Esplanade trip feasible, because they're all over, mainly out in the points. The trail keeps, if you couldn't call it that, the route goes westward in the canyon at the base of the Talus. So you've got the least difficulty with side canyons, but these tanks tend to be out more toward the rim.
Right.
And in the old USGS map, the first one of the Western Canyon, and it was called the Western Grand Canyon National Park, and it went on into what became the National Monument and then the park, this area we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They actually showed the tanks there. They're just a little blue circle,
right,
out on the point. Some of them are named, because they were a critical part of the cattleman's operation. And when Riffy and I flew around in his plane in Pogo, main thing we were looking for were the tanks.
Okay.
And it had rained really well. It was early spring when I was going out there.
Okay.
First time. Trip. It had rained well. The tanks at Torowie were full, and it had been the whole country rained. Trick is, you got to wait till the mud settles before you could drive out there.
Mm.
Then it's a balancing act to actually get there when everything's perfect with the storms, the mud, and the water in the tanks.
Right.
And so on this trip, not only found the route around easily, but I went out and checked all the tanks we had looked at by horseback. And I camped the first night I camped up at Tuckup Spring, up in the very head of the canyon. And then I went out along the, would be the west rim of Tuckup Canyon, and got across from the dome, which is the feature out there that's really interesting, this big towering I rocked this out in the middle of the canyon there.
Hey,
And,
Alan, can we back up for a minute?
Sure.
Can you tell me about the horses that you had? Where did you get them? And the outfit, saddles, pack saddle, you know, what did you have? What did you plan to bring?
Okay, yeah, I will. There's, I borrowed the horses from my friends at Moccasin, and just like I had borrowed when we went down Kanab Canyon with the cattlemen, and I, they were comfortable with that. They didn't say no.
Okay.
And so I had a, you know, our rough old Western saddle. There's nothing glamorous about them, and all the normal gear on the horse. The on the pack horse, it is kind of interesting, and I learned that it was a wooden sawback pack saddle, and it has a like two sticks crossed with X's tied and attached together with one stick along the backbone.
Okay.
So it's called a sawback, like a sawhorse that you cut wood at home is what it's called.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing to me as I got into it was that they were typical 100% historic Spanish packing, and that from Mexico to New Mexico to Arizona, they all had this type of pack saddle.
Okay.
And then what you packed in were two big canvas bags with a big loop on top of canvas or rope, and they were called alfogas, which is an Americanization of the Spanish alhoga, which is a big pack bag. It's the Spanish name for it.
How do you spell that?
And, oh, any way you want.
Okay.
Alfoga was what we called them, alfogas.
Okay, thank you.
I would did with that. And so you had two big sacks that were maybe 2 feet wide and foot and a half high. So I, what I had was my little backpack tent. Well, everything for my backpack. The air mattress and, again, back then no one would consider taking a pack stove or fuel. You just got a bunch of little sticks and made a tiny little fire. And I had the, I was just almost lost my train of thought. I, of course, the food I was going to eat, and now with the horse carrying it, there was more canned food than anything else.
Did you have to bring food for the stock, or were they just grassing it?
Well, they were grazing, but I had maybe 5-10 pound sack of oats.
Okay.
Yeah. Not rolled oats, but just plain oats, and they loved that. And in the morning, definitely, that's the first thing they got, and it was very easy to catch them then. But one horse, I tied them on long lead ropes.
Okay.
Which was another thing. Each of the horses had a big nylon, or no, it would have been a hemp rope, not nylon in those days, but for tying up at night, just because it was unpredictable what they'd do and where they'd go since they hadn't been down in there. And they were happy. They There was quite a bit of grass down in there that they could graze on. And each place we went, there was good water. I had canteen water for myself. And, you know, my big tripod and my 4x5 camera. And mainly I was exploring and just learning, you know, how to battle with the pack saddle on. It had all this these leather straps and went two around the belly, one around the front chest, one strap around the back end, and all had to be cinched just right so the pack saddle didn't flip off with all my stuff. So
right.
It was a, I just learned as I went and took it easy, and fortunately the two horses were very cooperative.
Okay, I'm just trying to think about the logistics here. You had a VW bus at the time, I think.
Yeah,
and
my friend had it. All the men out there had pickups with stock racks in the back where you could haul two horses in the back of a pickup.
Oh, okay.
And they would, you know, it was the cab over the head. Horse's head was over the cab. So, and they were all used to jumping in and out of a, you'd back up to a hill.
Okay.
Or a loading. Most corrals had a little pile of dirt that was left there specifically to back your truck up and lead your horses in and out. So
got it. All right.
My friend brought me out to the head of the tuck-up trail.
Okay.
And then I went around to Two Weep and got there. I think I was out 5 days, probably.
Okay.
And my friend, we had agreed that he'd drive down on that fifth day and I'd be there to, he could pick up and take off.
Right. Okay.
So,
all right. So, so that gives me an idea. You've kind of got two large alfoga either side of the sawback on one horse. The other horse is your saddle horse. Did you have some gear on your saddle horse as well?
Not really. I had a rubber poncho that I rolled up and tied up behind the saddle.
Okay.
I don't think I ever had to use it.
Okay.
Maybe under the tent or something, but.
And this may be a stupid question, but did you alternate your stock so that you rode one animal one day and then rode the second animal the next day while the first animal packed the gear, or did you just ride one animal and have the other animal?
In this case, I think I asked that, but they said the one horse was a riding horse and the other one was a pack horse.
Okay.
And don't try to change it. Don't try to switch that in midstream.
And did you hobble them at night? Would you tie their front hooves together on a short rope?
Not really. I've done that a lot in later years, but where we ended up, there were either big rocks or thing just to loop the rope around, and they would just stand there or lay down or
okay.
They were happy. And
okay.
In the morning, I'd feed them the grain and lead them over. Well, my camp was right there.
So right.
It was pack them up. And
yep.
That part I felt very comfortable about.
Okay. All right. Nice. Okay. Yeah. So you've gone down the tuck-up trail today. You know, still, that's quite a trail. A good trail winds itself down to a giant flat, a basalt flat, and then you head south out toward the dome to where you can start getting a real good picture of the dome, and you're on the esplanade. There's a big water tank out there. Did you go out to that tank? It's kind of on the northeast side of the dome.
Northeast? You mean a metal tank?
No, no. One of these potholes. One of the water.
Oh, a pothole tank. Yeah, yeah. Definitely, I went there, and see, a couple years later, I organized a Sierra Club highlight trip, where we took all the 20 people on this basically same trip, where they were hiking and I was organized packing the gear.
Okay.
Our first night on that trip was out at the big tank, a little northeast of the dome there.
Right.
And the whole group spent at least two nights, at least three nights there. And there were other tanks right nearby, smaller ones that we used to water the horses, and explained to everybody the do's and don'ts for using the big tank, which was our water source.
Right.
So, and back then, all you did was drop some drops of bleach in the water to purify it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I cringe right now, but that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Sierra Club group, one day we went back around down the side canyon and down to the Colorado and back, that little natural bridge down there. And,
oh, so you actually went down Tuckup all the way down to the river.
And back.
Okay.
And that was on this second trip with the Sierra Club.
So you didn't do that on your first trip?
No, no.
All right, so let's stick to the first trip. We'll get to that second trip.
Right.
So you've got around to then continuing on from the dome, where did you go and what did you do?
I continued west and went around to what the cattlemen call June Spring Canyon.
Okay.
It's the next big alcove there and canyon going down to Colorado, but you can't. Got a huge drop off.
So June Spring is that's not. Let's see. I'm trying to think about the lay of the land there from Tuckup down river. You're going to have Stairway Canyon, but is this before Stairway?
I'd have to look at it on a map because, to my point of view from up there, it was Tuckup, June Spring, Burrow Canyon, and Toroway.
Okay, and so we're thinking
those were the big alcoves.
Yeah, there's I think Fern Glen.
Yeah.
And then Stairway, and then Cove, and then
I think that's Burrow on top.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just
because obviously the cattlemen on top, had a completely different set of names than the river runners down below.
Oh, fascinating.
Which is appropriate.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
They were using the river differently.
So run these past me again. You've got Tuckup, and then moving west, June was next?
Yeah, it's the, if you imagine, I'm kind of picturing the Tuckup Canyon, and then the dome is on the watershed between Tuckup and June Spring.
Got it.
Canyon.
Okay, so I'm going to put in parents here, Fern Glen.
Yeah.
Okay, and then west of June?
Well, then there was Burrow Canyon, but there was there was a whole series of really good tanks out there you could see from the trail.
Okay.
Looking down the north side of Burrow Canyon and all. So June Spring was interesting because there was an old spring there that had been developed by the cattlemen, but it ran, it ran a good little stream, maybe half mile long, where the canyon just started up, eating its way down into the Esplanade, into the sandstone. So it was a very neat place with the water and the creek. And then I don't remember whose grazing allotment that had been in June spring, because there was a horse trail coming off the rim down to June spring.
Right.
And on top, somewhere up there, there's what's called Boisag Point.
Yep.
On the rim.
Yes.
And below that, you're kind of looking at the June spring area. That's where you come out.
Was that water good to drink?
I definitely drank it, and the horses drank it, and
I must be confusing it with another spring in that area, which is, the water's just not so good. But
with the alkaline?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's the way I used to explain it as Epsom salts crystallizing around the edge of it. And that's, crudely speaking, there are several springs were squat down springs. In other words, when you drink some of that water, you better be squatting down, ready to, it's going to clean your system out from one end to the other.
Right, right.
And I back then didn't have any way of purifying the water or the minerals.
Right.
And I remember only one night later on the top of the Red Wall in Kanab Canyon that I was stuck in a spring that was really terrible. But that's what you have to do.
Yeah. And so you're going along, you found good trail works around down into the bottom of the drainages and up the other side, and then you'd kind of make your way along the flats of the Esplanade to the next drainage and then down and up.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's just, I got to realize when you were on one side of a drainage heading toward the head of it, you just look over on the left side of the other rim, and as long as you're really carefully looking, you can say, oh, there's a trail coming up there.
Okay.
I didn't have any problems. The trail, it wasn't that good a trail because, especially in that June spring area, the cattlemen were not there maintaining it, not using it.
Right.
So it was quick disintegrating.
And would you run into fences or gates as you crossed from allotment to allotment?
Yeah, and it was always at what you'd call the watershed between one drainage to the other.
Okay.
So to get from June spring drainage, if you're going west, you have to go up over a little hill or sometimes a ridge and through a pass and down the other side to get into Burrow.
Okay.
But at that pass is where they pile up all this cedar post debris. They were very effective, but not very prettier. They weren't fences. They were just effective barriers.
Okay.
And so sometimes when I had to take them apart to go through with my horses and then put them back up again.
Okay.
Even though there weren't cattle in there, I thought the idea of leaving them the way I found them was kind of important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So from the dome heading west around Burrow and then toward the next canyon, What's the it? What's Cove? Well, what's the name for Cove?
Cove is the last one before Tuweep.
Yes.
Toraweep, right? Yeah. And I don't think they had a name for it.
Okay.
Way out there, you came to kind of the remains of a jeep road that went out to a mine that, it was some of the locals. I don't think it was, it could have even been Al Craig, definitely. And I don't think it was the Bundys, but there was a group of families. It would be pushing it to call it a consortium, but they had a mine down on the base of the the Esplanade, the cliff, and the top of the Red Wall.
Right.
Along there's just a talus slope, and there in that area there are several chimneys that are old volcanic features that blew through the sandstone and filled up with all sorts of other debris, and some of it was interesting enough that people spent a lot of time digging tunnels in them to get minerals out. And at that mine, we're just east of Toraweep campground and all. One day I did go down there on foot, and it was pretty hairy getting around there because the trail had really left in and was gone. And there is an adit over there, tunnel going in and talus coming out. And apparently Riffy had told me that the group had take one dump truck of ore and whatever it was. It could have been uranium, but I doubt it. He was talking more like silver or something bizarre. But anyway, they hauled it out and drove it up to Provo, Utah, to the big smelter, and they smelted it, and they really didn't make, they got some money, but it didn't really cover the mining and the trip up and the trip back. So
let's talk about this a little bit. I know we're kind of off on a tangent because I do want to get you back to your horses and finish that trip off.
Yeah.
That mine is a really fascinating deal, and it had a tramway, a barbless wire tramway going from the rim. There was also a ladder that made out of that same barbed wire with wooden rungs that went over the edge down this cliff face for a little while until it got into a little slot, a little chute, and then worked the chute down through the esplanade there to the top of the Red Wall. There was a camp down there. Do you remember any of that stuff?
Yeah, I was gonna. I was trying to decide whether to mention that there was a tramway of some kind, a very small.
Yeah.
That they hauled the. That probably was just hauling the ore in buckets to the top.
Right.
It's kind of how involved it was. I don't remember the wire ladder going down. When I came off, you went in the first little, you went just east of where the mine was and went down a little side canyon, or actually you could climb down to the top of the Red Wall there and come around maybe a couple hundred yards, not a quarter mile, and be to that. And it was interesting to see once, but I didn't want to go back.
Okay.
Mainly because the slope, the talus was sliding off behind me as I ran across the stuff, and it was just pouring over the Red Wall, and there was a good around there. And but that was a, I think that was definitely the last mine in the two-leaf area.
Okay. All right, let's go back to your pack trip here. You're crossing now Burro Canyon. I guess that would be Stairway down on the river.
Yeah.
And then working on the Esplanade, in and out and in and out, to pick up the road. The road then would take you to the Toroweep campground?
Yeah, just before it.
Okay.
You know, it comes in there, and there was a spring there, about 100 yards from the, or less, from the campground out there.
Okay.
Did you go to that spring?
Just east of the campground?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was piped mainly over to that mining operation.
Right.
And
right.
Possibly to some of the cows, because everywhere there was a drop of water, they would do everything they could to get one or two cows in there.
Right. So it sounds like your trip was fairly uneventful.
It was. It was a great pleasure. I couldn't believe how lucky I was, because the weather was right, the road was passable to get in and out without the mud, and the pockets were still full.
Nice.
And
were there flowers?
Oh yeah, a lot of flowers. I just explored it and enjoyed it and found it really hospitable place. You know, this was a neat place to come and hike and camp, and I didn't know if too many people would bring horses to go around there, but it was a good learning place for me.
Okay.
And I have a hard time remembering, but there's every indication that I know that the next thing I did was continued west from Two-Weep, and I took the trail around the base of the, what are the mountains right there with the cinder cones on top?
Vulcan's Throne?
Well, you go between Vulcan's Throne and the range of mountains. It ends up on Mount Trumbull.
Right, so I'm thinking a Paw's Pocket is in there, and then you head over to Whitmore,
right,
through the Whitmore Road. Yeah.
That's what I did, because we had flown that, and so I can, after spending a night with Riffy, I went, and I had planned this, so my friend wasn't waiting for me there when I came out that time, as I continued on and went around to the Whitmore Road.
Okay.
And then went west from there up through a saddle and over into Parashant.
Frog Springs is out there?
Yes. Frog Springs, a big concrete tank, tall one. It wasn't just a watering trough. It's about 6 or 8 feet high.
Okay.
And then a watering town, but it hadn't been used. It was Bundy's, but it hadn't been used in a long time.
Okay.
And between there and Parashant, somewhere out in that area, and I don't at the moment know why it was there, but there was a really nice line cabin. And a line cabin is that the cattlemen use when they come out to move the animals in or to take them out. And it's just a one-room cabin that basically just has a couple of bunks and roll-up mattresses that you put up in the attic, and it'll have some pots and pans and whatever. But it's just, you know, a little house out there. or a cabin, but
right, and that was
very
that
minimal.
Was that just west of the Whitmore Trail Road? You cross Whitmore Creek there, and on this road that's going out toward Frog Springs, and then past that line shack.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know I stayed there.
Okay.
And there was, of course, the Frog Spring, and then going down into the trail into Parashat, there was a spring there, just a seep that you could get a couple cups of water, and the horses got a little. So,
okay.
And I actually took the horses back up again and tied them to something, I don't know what, by the spring, and then hiked down into the bottom of Parashat and up to the mine on the other side.
Okay.
There's the copper mine over there.
Yes.
And just checking out, I was surprised to see that there was an airstrip there, and it hadn't been used in years and years, but it was completely usable.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Just out of curiosity, and then came back to Riffey's, and that's when my friend came and picked me up.
Got it. How many photographs did you take on that first trip? Any idea?
Not very many.
Okay.
I decided, I looked back at it and said I was focusing completely on the logistics of getting me and the two horses along this trail for a distance for several days and to see what would happen or wouldn't happen. And,
yeah.
And these were good trail horses that were used to being out there. And they were very cooperative, and they seemed to enjoy it, and I definitely enjoyed it. And then later that year and the next thing, came back, especially on the rim of the canyon above all those points, and took several really good pictures down onto the Esplanade and over toward Havasu, because that's what you're basically looking at from on top.
Okay. All right.
So there were a few color slides that I took, 35 millimeters.
Okay.
And then other trips I had where I took a lot more pictures.
Hey, Alan, are you walking around? There's a lot of phone disturbance going on.
Oh, no, I'm not. I should just hold the phone up in front of me. I was in my swivel chair. It was sitting on my desk, and I just noticed that I turned around away from it.
Oh, okay. So, I was like, something's up. Yeah, oh, good. Okay, all right, good. Were you working for Pipe Springs at the time, and was this part of your vacation, or how did you get the time off?
Oh, I basically would take the time off, but this trip that I described, that might have been before the season started at Pipe Springs.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because it was a seasonal position.
Got it.
And when you bring that up, why I was out there and was having a good time was I mentioned Zion Park was over Pipe Springs.
They yes.
Controlled it. And the interpreter over there, I got to know quite well.
Who was that?
I think his last name was Lewis.
Okay.
It was a guy I could find out because he was a photographer.
Ah.
And he had actually published the first photo book of Zion the whole park.
Oh, okay.
Just, you know, page after page of neat, colorful pictures. And in the captions, he tried to teach as much as he could about the geology and the plants and animals.
Oh, fun.
It was a small, probably, you know, 5x7 or 7x8 paperback book with, you know, shiny paper picture book.
Nice.
And this was extremely unusual. What became the Zion Natural History Association, published it, and they sold it in the visitor center.
Okay.
And this is kind of a digression, but not really, because I became really intertwined between Zion and what I was doing. Because I got to know him, and I'm showing his pictures, and he was indirectly over the interpretation of Pipe Springs. So any of the exhibits I made there, I had to get his approval first. So we got to know each other. And he showed me in this museum at Zion. And I don't know if you went there, if you had been there in the old days.
No.
It was in the old stone building. It's not near the visitor center and parking lots and shuttle buses today. It was a nice old-fashioned park museum.
Hmm.
And he showed me that whoever was there before him, and probably two or three guys back, when they made that museum and made the exhibits, and the idea was to have some nice big color photographs, kind of almost mural-like, but small. In other words, you looked at whatever the scene was in front with the animals, and behind it was a photo that went along with it. And they had, either it was the age or the lack of experience, not age of the person, the back in the days there, it was
right.
Hard to get color photographs. Well, they had completely washed out.
Oh.
The museum looked horrible because behind every exhibit there was one of these great big 3x4 foot photographs, and they didn't have the negatives, and they didn't want to reprint them because it really wasn't up to the standards of the late 60s. And he asked if I could photograph to replace all the photos in the museum with
oh, wow.
modern photographs. And this was, and I said sure. And so we set up a deal where I would come over on my weekends, which was midweek usually, my days off.
Okay.
And I'd stay in the ranger dorm and go out in the park carrying my 4x5 and recreating. Well, actually, we'd talk about in every exhibit what did he want as the big photograph.
Okay.
And then I would go out and photograph a couple, and he would pick it, and then we sent them off to a modern photo finisher in Texas to be printed, and with good long-lasting inks. And the main problem was to get the right lighting in the exhibits, because that's what mainly destroyed the prints before. And then, so I spent 5 or 6 weeks, weekends, days off, in Zion, hiking everywhere from one end of the park to the other.
Oh, fun.
And taking the photographs. And I had really free range as to what I wanted to use behind. You know, if the exhibit was about the Great White Throne and all, it had to be a picture of the Great White Throne
right.
that was given, and the whole riparian design, you could have, I could have any picture of the Virgin River, and really, I got a lot out of it. He got the pictures that were excellent, and he and I installed them, and to much acclaim.
Oh, fun.
And the funny thing is that those pictures, that whole set of exhibits, the whole museum was there till they built the new one for at the Transit Center. And I want to say those pictures were there for 20 years.
Nice.
It amazed me. I'd go back and kind of come through the door cringing to see what happened to my beautiful pictures, and they were still there.
Oh.
For years and years.
So, huh, super.
It just made a big thing. And then the other thing that brings it back to Grand Canyon is that I think through the park there somehow I met up with Gregory Crampton, and he was a professor at University of Utah, history, and an outdoorsman. And in the late 50s, 1950s, he was contracted by the Bureau of Reclamation to make the first and last historic survey of the Glen Canyon that was about to be destroyed.
Right.
And so they organized it for him. He spent a couple months in there photographing, writing up, and then following up, going all around the area, talking to descendants and to see what was going on in there, because he found just a wealth of historic information in there.
Right.
He published his first book was, I'll probably have a block. It's still in print, really. And it's a picture book, and he's telling the history of Glen Canyon. Oh, it's got a clever name. You've probably seen it, but and it goes, well, the whole Glen Canyon. It talks about what they found. A lot of the Indian remains, the historic, the miners. There was a major gold rush in Glen Canyon in the 1890s that he documented, and he had a really good, it was a great book, and I learned a lot from it. And then he retired and moved to St. George, and then decided he was going to continue and do the same book for the Grand Canyon.
Ah.
And he did. But he sought me out, and I met him, and then in later couple years, he ended up either writing to me or phoning or telling me what he needed in the way of a picture of a place. And I would go out and take the pictures and send them to him, and he would pick what he wanted for the book. And especially a lot of it did down in the Grand Canyon, because he, there's Lee's Ferry, Berea Canyon pictures, the various historic things, a lot of historic pictures, but more black and whites of what it looks like today, and really encouraging people to understand the history and the geology, and that book's still in print too. But
so this would have been Ghosts of Glen Canyon?
No.
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 Or historic Glen Canyon. He wrote a couple books about that. About Glen.
When we moved to this new house, my library is here, but I'm not sure where. It's the land of living rock.
Oh, okay.
And I ended up, producing most of the modern pictures for that book. I was really proud of it.
Nice.
I'm going to have to come back when I have time to really look for that. I have a couple copies, I know, of that book for my family and kids. And,
And Alan, what do you remember about Crampton? What was he like?
He was really nice. Very outgoing. He's like you in a way. When you were with him, you wanted to talk.
Okay.
You wanted to tell him everything you knew and places to go and things. And he listened. He was appreciative. The only problem, which was no real secret, but every time he came out on one of his field trips and would stop in, he had a female graduate student with him.
Okay.
Different ones every time. And that was, in that day and age, was unusual, but didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, but he was, very knowledgeable and got the book done. I mean, talked about Bundyville, about all the stuff out at mouth of the Grand Canyon, the Virgin River down there.
Okay.
Before I go any further, I have one thing I'm going to digress, but not completely, but it's a story of the western Grand Canyon that I keep forgetting to tell you, and it's Chet Bundy's brother that, remember, at this time, he and his wife were quite elderly and basically surviving out a mile or two from Riffy's house.
Right, that was Pat. Right.
Pat Bundy, okay. And one of the times we went there, he always wanted to talk, and he was a storyteller of the old generation. And he told a story, which I love, and it ties a lot of what we talk about, the historic use of the Grand Canyon. When he was he was a young man, which in his case probably meant 14, 15, 16 or something.
Right.
His dad, or one of the extended family, got him a job for the summer, and it was on a ranch north and east of Kingman, Arizona.
Okay.
And this was a long time ago, a lot older than me. It's between the old Route 66 and the Hualapai land. There's all that country out there north of Ash Fork, and that's where I got the impression.
Okay.
But he had his horse, as of course, but he rode down off the west side of the Siwits Plateau to the, really, whatever the road there was along the Virgin there that crossed at Pierce's Ferry.
Yep.
And then rode his horse up to Kingman area or wherever the ranch was. It was way out in the boonies. And he spent the summer there as a cowboy. And he said right away, his first thing, that it was a good summer, and he made a little money, but he really didn't like the job at all because it involved rounding up calves and putting his boss's brand on them, even though the mothers had a different brand.
Ooh.
And he flat said it was not a small-time rustling operation. The guy he was working for was a cattleman and had a big herd, but he definitely augmented his herd every year with this.
Wow.
He knew where and when and how to do it. And Pat said, I didn't like it. That kind of bothered me, and I was always looking over my shoulder, sort of thing. But the part that I love is that when he finished, he was paid, and he didn't say how much. To us, it would have been, probably $50 at the most. But
right.
Anyway, he went into Kingman, and he bought a bicycle.
Wow.
And he rode it home to Bundyville.
Wow.
Back the way he came. He went to where, I guess, Meadview is now, and down to Pierce's Ferry, crossed the ferry, and then rode up the Virgin up to where the trail went up on the Siwits Plateau.
Right.
Went across the Siwits Plateau and down to Bundyville. And he definitely had the only bicycle in Bundyville. I think his father was kind of dismayed that he sold his horse to get it, too.
Oh, my.
So he had this bicycle covered with whatever he brought with him, not much, but he so proudly rode up to the house in Bundyville on his bicycle, and there were more questions than not. And I asked Riffy later, because he sat there and heard this too and was laughing and smiling, and I said, "Is that story, can that be true?" And he says, "Yeah, I think so. He loves to tell stories, but I have an idea that one was true."
Yeah. Then this would have been 1915, 1920 time period.
Yeah.
Huh.
Right.
Huh.
Back then. It's just.
Wow.
It just showed me, And the Bundys did cross over at Whitmore, and had a way up the out of the canyon on the south side, and would ride forever to get wherever they were going.
Okay.
On there, but that story I really liked.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's lovely. That's lovely. We've been going for about an hour here.
Yep.
maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history series.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's do that then. This will conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Wednesday, November. Actually, it's Tuesday. I'm sorry.
Tuesday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tuesday, November 1, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom.